This is Andre Traversa with my lovely co-host Paula Thompson. You know, the Bible portrays the Apostle Paul as a persecutor of Christians, and that, you know, he was converted when he heard Jesus say, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And he changed his name to Paul. Now, that is not in the Urantia book at all. The Urantia book does not mention Paul as a persecutor of Christians. I always sort of took it for granted that that Paul was a persecutor of Christians. I didn't have any reason to doubt that part of the Bible. But somebody I know thought maybe that was written into the text somehow to make the conversion story of Paul more dramatic. Now, it's interesting because there are a lot of things in the Bible that we know are questionable, but that was something I never doubted. Even very liberal biblical scholars don't doubt that particular part of the scripture. I just thought it was very interesting to consider and to think about. I happen to know a Pauline scholar who is a reader of the Urantia book, but I'm not sure we can get him on. He's works at a major university, and I'm not sure if he wants to be outed as a reader or not. But but it's just, I just thought it was something really interesting to think about.
Yeah, I've heard it put forth that perhaps Paul himself was one of the Pharisees, or that one of the leaders that was instrumental in bringing about Jesus' death. I know that's very controversial to say that, but I've heard a very compelling presentation along those lines, that perhaps Paul himself was one of the men who was very distraught and angry about Jesus and his ministry, and was actually one of the men who sought after his death.
Well, that's very interesting. This particular person is actually saying the opposite. He was saying that maybe Paul didn't do those things at all, that somehow that was written into the Bible to make Paul's conversion story more dramatic, because in the Urantia book, it just refers to Paul as a tent maker. It doesn't. Now, I guess I always assumed that Paul really was a persecutor of Christians, and if he wasn't, the Revelators would have told us otherwise. You know, because that's how the Bible portrays him. So I figured they just sort of assumed that we knew that. But it's just an interesting thing to consider. You know, which parts here are true, which parts are not. You know.
Well, and it does say that one of the most important factors of the spread of Christianity was the conversion of Paul.
Right.
On the Damascus Road.
Oh, it does say that. Okay, that's interesting. Well, in that case,
the word conversion makes me think, conversion. He converted from something. If it wasn't a persecutor of Christians, then maybe it was, you know, just, I don't know.
Regular Judaism.
Maybe regular Judaism. Yeah.
Again, folks, this show is open phones, so please feel free to call in. 646-716-8158, 646-716-8158. You know, I keep getting that confused because I think 716 is an area code to somewhere else, so that's why I keep confusing me. So, Paula, tell us, is there anything that's been on your heart, on your mind, any particular passages maybe of the Revelation that have particularly struck you recently?
Well, always. I mean, you know, it's just a constant thing every day for me. And, you know, I want to say that August the 21st is what the Urantia book says is Jesus' birthday. And it goes into some depth, and scholars realize that Jesus wasn't born on the 25th of December. They know that that's a Mithraic holiday. A pagan holiday, and they know that, you know, even the Bible says that the shepherds were abiding in their fields, and, you know, in December that would be highly unlikely. And beyond that, Herod, if Herod died in 3 B.C., historically, how could Herod have sent his men out to slaughter those one-year-old children, after Jesus' birth, when Jesus was a year old? That just doesn't compute. So scholars typically understand that Jesus was not born when we think he was, but they just don't know when he was born. The Urantia book says that he was born on August the 21st, 7 B.C., at high noon. And so it's wonderful, I think, that we Urantia book readers get two Christmases. One is, you know, the great tradition that we've had for these many years. It's very commercial now. It's a lot of fun. We give a lot of gifts. We go all out. We do this. But the other one is a very high, holy, sacred commemoration for your Rancho Book readers of the fact that Jesus bestowed himself on our planet and incarnated on our world and gave us the greatest gift that has ever been given to humanity on this planet, a life lived in the Spirit. And you mentioned, there's just no words that describe how you feel when you've read the Urantia book about Jesus. It's transcendental. It's a meaning without a word. And you mentioned Vern Grimsley, and just in commemoration, because I know a lot of Urantia book readers are going to be going out today to picnics. We have the best time. You know, we go and we have a picnic, and we talk about Jesus, and we talk about what his life has meant to us, and we share that with each other, and we have a birthday party for the Master. We don't give gifts, but we just celebrate the fact of Jesus' birth, and it's so wonderful. And Vern Grimsley wrote a poem, and, you know, Vern is an amazing poet. Some of my favorite poems ever, and I love poetry, have been written by Vern. But this is one just to commemorate Jesus' birthday, because I know that all of us listening are thinking about that. Maybe we're heading off to celebrations. I know I am. This is a poem by Vern. It's called This Child of Heaven. This child of heaven, born of earth, who slumbers at his mother's breast, is God and man, and by his birth shall all of humankind be blessed. This child of heaven, silent here, shall one day with a mighty voice teach faith to vanquish mortal fear. Let every human heart rejoice. This child of heaven, frail and weak, who slumbers in this midnight hour, shall one day stand and stride and speak with godly, manly, mighty, mighty power. This child of heaven, born of earth, who slumbers at his mother's breast, is God and man, and by his birth shall all of humankind be blessed.
Wow. You know, Paula, one of the things that you said that I'd like to take a step further is you said that, you know, we get two Christmases. It's funny, I can relate to this, by the way, because growing up, my family was Ukrainian Catholic, and they were what's called Eastern Rite Catholic, which means they celebrated under a different calendar. They celebrated under the Julian calendar rather than the Gregorian calendar, so they would actually have Christmas on the 6th and 7th of January. That was on my mom's side, but then on my dad's side, they would celebrate on the 25th. So I did get two. I still get two Christmases. So I guess I get three now because, you know, we've got the August 21st. But I'll take it a step further. I know some readers of the Urantia book that don't really want to celebrate Jesus' birth on the 25th. And that's fine. That's a personal choice. But, you know, I celebrate Jesus' birth on both days because, you know what? First of all, I love Christmas carols. There's some great theology in some of the Christmas carols.
Oh.
One of my favorite ones is Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
And one of the
verses I love in there was it says, veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity. I mean, what a wonderful celebration of the incarnation. And that's just another opportunity to celebrate the birth of Jesus. I actually don't care for the secularism and the commercialism that Christmas has become. I guess the point I'm making simply is, you know, I personally don't want to go to the opposite extreme and say, well, I'm not going to celebrate Christmas on the 25th because, you know, I know for a fact that it's August 21st, so why should I, you know? And again, that's a personal choice people can make if they don't want to celebrate Christmas or they don't want to acknowledge the birth of Jesus. But, I mean, to me, you know, why not acknowledge the birth of Jesus as often as I possibly can?
You know, I take that, the Remembrance Supper, which is, as you know, a tradition that has been carried down at communion over the last 2,000 years, and it's very sacred to so many people, and it is to me. And the Urantia book really gives a different take on the Remembrance Supper. He's with his apostles, and he says, you know, and it's the Last Supper, and he passes the wine, and he says, this is my spirit, you know, and the bread, this is the sustenance, the bread that, you know, the Father gives. And it's a great, they're both great metaphors.
Hmm.
But he says something that always sticks with me, and it keys in on what you just said, Andre. He says, and in as often as you do this, remember me and the life that I lived among you. And so I take it to say, to mean, every time you eat and drink and sustain your life, which is your gift from the Heavenly Father, remember me and the life that I lived among you. It doesn't have to be this special moment where you, you know, you say, okay, now I'm going to remember Jesus. It can be as often as you eat and drink. And that's pretty often. And
yes.
I think that,
that's a good
you know,
point, yes.
Yeah, I like holding that in my heart. And it is a sacred rendezvous, as the Urantia book says. It is our sacred rendezvous with the Master himself. And
I think too, that, you know, Paula, there's so many places we can go with that in our minds. I mean, we can think about eating and drinking with Jesus. We can think about the fact that Jesus was a human being who sat down to dinner, and you know, he's just a guy that you could hang out with. You could eat dinner with, you know.
I love that.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, his enemies called him a glutton and a drunkard, so he must have been a pretty good, you know, he must have been a good time sort of Charlie, you know.
I get that, Andre, and you know, I think that that's exactly why when he was sitting there at that party having a good time, and those Pharisees came in and they gave him a hard time, and they said, look, here you are sitting with these common people having a good time. You're drinking with publicans and sinners. And
yes, yes.
To me, that's endearing, because he didn't come here to judge us. And certainly we know that Jesus never did anything unsavory or untoward ever in his whole life. But he was able to sit and laugh with his friends just like we do, and play games and rest and refresh himself just like we do. And he needed that just like we do. And he encouraged us to do that. So,
yeah,
you know,
it's funny, you know, Paul, because you say that that he didn't come here to judge us. Well, you know, that's because Jesus, what is Jesus? He's our brother, and he's also our father. You know, a good parent doesn't come to judge their children either. You know, a good parent, you know, not only loves their children, but understands that, hey, these are my kids. They're kids. They're not adults yet. So I'm gonna, you know, I'll treat them the way that children should be treated, and I'll take into account the fact that they're still growing and still maturing, and that's the kind of attitude I believe Jesus had with us. But I think it's so interesting you say that he could play, because I just think about how much he loves children, and that's something, of course, that is already a part of our Western consciousness here in the West, at least. And I would say, you know, wherever Christianity has flourished, we already understand that Jesus loved children. In fact, I think even the Urantia book tells us that prior to Christianity, you know, the pagans would, you know, if they had a child they didn't want, they would just throw the child out into the cold and leave it there, you know, to die. Whereas as Christians wouldn't do that. I look at the Bible talks a little bit about Jesus bonding with children, but the Urantia book gives us even more detail. It talks about how even prior to his public ministry, when Jesus was working as a carpenter, you know, the kids would come out and they would tug at his hands and they'd say, "Oh, Uncle Joshua, tell us another big story." You know, that's just one of the things I just find it's such a fond memory when I think about that, you know, and read that. You know, it's just one of those special passages in the book for me.
Well, it's like that great quote, the divine counselor says, "I think I would love God just so much, just as much, in spite of his power and his strength, as long as he is so good and so merciful." And, you know, it is the goodness of Jesus that, you know, that comes out in his human life. It just, it's so amazing. And I think that we humans tend to take ourselves entirely too seriously, in that the weight of the world just crushes us. And I think that's why you see right now, especially in the developed countries and especially in the United States, so many people are depressed. they're anxious and they're worried and they're, you know, it seems like it's just hard to find happiness. And I noticed that what came to me at our conference last month, we kicked that conference off, as you remember, with Pat O'Banton, who gave us a wonderful reggae concert first thing in the morning on the first day. And we could have been all reverent and solemn and somber, but Pato called us to play and worship. And he started to, you know, do what he does, which is, I mean, when Pato and the band start to play, you just can't sit still.
Right.
And if you can, I'm amazed. But what happened was a few people got up and started to dance, and then pretty soon a few more people got up and started to dance. Pretty soon the whole darn auditorium was rocking. We were playing. We were having fun. And what came to me was, you know, somebody let God's children out to play.
That's right. That's right.
Isn't that wonderful? And it set the tone for the whole conference. And I think sometimes we humans just need to have fun and play with abandon. Just let ourselves go. Quit being embarrassed or shy about getting up and dancing and moving.
Well, you know what? I mean, of course we need to do that, because that's why the book says that there are reversion directors. Wouldn't it be great to become a reversion director?
Well, you would be a good one.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, that's... That's definitely part of our I mean, the book also says that the ascension scheme is equally divided into work and play. You know, so obviously play is, not only is play important, but play is part of our ascension. It's part of what, you know, it's part of what we're here for. So I would like to, again, give out our phone number, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. Please give us a call. Anything you want to talk about, it's open phones today. So, you know, if you have maybe you have feedback on our show, maybe you have suggestions for guests or for topics, or maybe there's just something you'd like to share that's, you know, on your heart, maybe even, you know, you may even have something you'd like us to pray about or something. Who knows? Whatever it might be, give us a call, 646-716-8158.
Okay, so, Andre, there's a question on our... on our little discussion board.
Okay.
A kind of a question. It was, you know, it's posed that can we all be ministers as we pass by? You know, some of us come in from a long season in the wilderness, and we are, or we're isolated, and maybe we can't be a minister then, because we've been by ourselves too long. What do you think about that, Andre? Can we all be ministers as we pass by?
Oh, and not only can we, I think, well, first, I think in a lot of ways we are. You know, I was at another conference. I was at the ICOA conference with you, as you know, Paul. I was also at another conference, the VAI conference in Kansas City, and a good friend of mine, Harry Menton, got up and spoke there, and he, one of the things he was challenging us to do, I don't know if a lot of people really got this, but this is one of the things I really got from his speech. He challenged us to rethink our paradigm of what service means. And this kind of falls into line with what you're saying. Don't get me wrong, I think it's great to do service projects. I think it's great to serve at a soup kitchen. There's a lot of bonding that takes place between people when people serve together. But I think a lot of times, you know, we're serving even when we don't even think about it a lot of times. You know, a friend of ours calls and asks us for a favor and we do a favor, that's service. That's ministry. So I think a couple of things. I think that a lot of times we are ministering when we pass by. If we have a relationship with God, and God is you know, the supreme and most important person in our lives, then we're going to naturally, you know, the service and ministry is naturally going to be a byproduct of that relationship. I think the other thing I would say is that ministry is, you know, I think your answer book kind of doesn't say much about clergy versus laity. I think the more we can break that distinction down, the better. I mean, I'd like to see churches, for example, not just have the same person preach a sermon every Sunday, but, you know, let the laity come up and preach. Let, you know, the more participation, and that's one of the things I love about the Arantia movement, is there are no clergy in the movement. Everybody, you know, potentially can be a teacher or a leader. You know, it's not a question, when you're doing that, you're not in a position of authority. You're just exercising the gift of leadership, which some, you know, a lot of us have, or the gift of teaching, or whatever it might be. So I think that, you know, that yes, that not only, I'd say two things. Again, one is that we do minister a lot of times when we pass by in ways we probably aren't even aware of. You know, we plant seeds all the time, and we're going to find out, I think, you know, as we enter eternity, or maybe even in the next life, the seeds we've planted, things that we didn't even think about. The other thing is, as I said, we're all ministers. You don't have to be ordained to be a minister.
Hear, hear. Hey, we have some callers.
Good.
Hold on. Here we
go.
Hi, you're on the Cosmic Citizen. Are you there? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, I can. Who's this?
Oh, hi. I'm in Lawrence. I'm a forensic psychologist by trade, but I'm a... I've worked a lot in emergency medicine over the years. And I was listening to what you said about basically... And sometimes a lot of people will minister and won't even realize. And I agree with you. You don't have to be ordained. You just have to be a true Christian and a believer, and understand that Joel is far deeper than just the words of the book. That you're getting the faith of the heart that comes along with it.
Yeah, excuse me, sir. I have to tell you, something's going on. I don't know what's happening, but you're cutting in and out as you talk. I'm hearing only parts of what you're saying. Are you having that problem, Paula?
Yeah, I'm hearing every other word is like disappearing.
Yeah, I don't know. Are you on a cell phone?
That's happening on your end as well.
Oh, that's odd. I wonder why. Well, anyway, yeah, that's kind of strange. Anyway, that's one of the technical glitches of live radio here. But your name is Lars, you said?
Morgan Lawrence, yes.
I'm sorry?
Morgan Lawrence, he said.
Morgan Lawrence?
Yeah.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
Well, Morgan, I'm glad that you understand what we're talking about here. Can you think of, and I know we're having a hard time with your connection, but maybe we can make the best of it here. Can you think of maybe some situations, maybe where you've ministered to people and you weren't even aware that you were doing it, and then later you found out that you planted a special seed and it really was kind of a spiritual experience for you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Anytime you are in a death situation where you're trying to help the person. Surroundings and save a life, you may or may not be ministering at that moment. Anything that protects the life, be it psychological, physical, or just is ministering. The rhetoric can be in many different forms, but if the concept, the basic Christian ministering, whether you know it or not.
You know, I want to say that I feel that ministry is a matter of the heart, and it is a matter of a person who really cares about other people. And one thing that sticks with me always is a saying by Zig Ziglar, the great sales motivator and guru. But this just really struck me because I was listening to a tape by him on sales and how to be an effective salesperson. But the thing he said I think is true across the board and especially with ministry. He said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so I think anybody who attempts to be a minister for folks, wants to communicate first to those people how much they care, and then secondly, you know, how much they know or what they have to offer to help. But it's that caring, and I think that's how Jesus was able to, you know, profoundly change a person just with a smile. The book tells us that, you know, just smiling on a person increased that person's ability to solve their own problems. Isn't that interesting? I've always found that a very interesting statement.
Yeah. Hey, Morgan, we're going to unfortunately have to let you go because unfortunately our connection is not very good. I don't know what the problem is, but feel free to call in again if you could get on a landline. I don't know if you're on a cell phone now. If you can get on a landline, that might be better. So, but we do appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Paula, I really want to piggyback on what you just said because I think that as we Rancho Book readers too, I think sometimes there's a temptation I think for us to wax eloquent about philosophical concepts in the book and about the seven absolutes, and all those things are important. Obviously, they reveal them to us for a reason. But if we just stay in that place, it's not and not feed a hungry soul who's in need. And only minister to their mind and neglect their heart and neglect their real needs, we may not be getting very far. So I think it's important for us too to nourish our own hearts as well. You know, the book talks about watering the garden of your heart,
absolutely,
as well as the dry sands of knowledge. So if we get our own heart fed, then we can we can feed others as well because we realize the value of that and the importance of that.
Oh, I just think that, God gives us these opportunities every day to minister to our fellows as we pass by. And we just have to be open to them. But the other side of it, I think, is also we have to be willing then to take a little time out of our private lives to really do that well, to give to people what they need at this moment, because sometimes that takes more time than we're willing to give.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's a key, We just have to be willing to give people, sometimes it takes an hour. Sometimes you could be, with somebody for two solid hours. Sometimes it's 2 hours every day for a week or a month. Or on a regular basis for a year. Ministry is a commitment. And, you can do it as you pass by, but sometimes more is required of that.
Yes, I would agree. I also would say that friendship can be a kind of ministry.
Absolutely.
I would make a distinction between ministry and friendship because sometimes we try to be friends with people that we can only minister to, and that doesn't always work. But I also would argue that the best friendship includes ministry, a mutual ministry. And there are going to be times when we need to minister more to someone than they can give back to us. But I think the key, though, is, as long as we're not being drained by the process, I think the key, the key is that we, I think ministry for me, if I'm really, if it's really going well, then I always get something out of it, though. It's always a joy for me. To give. If I'm not getting something out of it, if I'm feeling drained and I'm getting the life sucked out of me, then I need to either reexamine, am I getting burned out, or is there something about this relationship or the way that I'm ministering that isn't working?
Well, that's a good point. Hey, we got a note again on the message board that says from Gerald C. Hi, Gerald. He says wants us to talk about Melchizedek and his mission a bit.
Okay. Well, you know what? The thing I love about this open phones thing is we don't have to stay on one topic. We can go wherever the Spirit leads. So obviously, maybe that's where the Spirit is wanting us to go for the next few minutes or whatever. Honestly, Paula, I haven't read the Melchizedek Papers in a while. I just read a little bit of a few passages recently because a friend of mine sent some to a list that I was on. So I was reading a little bit about the Melchizedek teachings in the Levant in particular. And, for those of you who don't know, Melchizedek was, according to the Rancho book, was a superhuman being who incarnated here on this planet and spoke with Abraham A lot of the places in the Bible where Abraham is supposed to be talking to God, a lot of those cases he's actually talking to Melchizedek. The Bible does mention Melchizedek, but it doesn't say anything about who he was. It just calls him the king of Salem. So a lot of people think he was just an ordinary king. According to the Arantia book, he was not. He was a superhuman being who came here to spread monotheism, to spread the concept of one God, and to try to upstep the evolutionary religions, the earthly religions, maybe to get them away from things like sacrifice and things like that. That was quite a task, though, because it didn't. unfortunately, what ended up happening was a lot of the man-made religions still had sacrifice as part of their system. But anyway, it's interesting. You know, the Mormons find Melchizedek to be very important. They have a whole priesthood set up based on Melchizedek. That's sort of what comes to mind, though, when I think about Melchizedek. What is it that comes to your mind when you think about his mission and what he was here for?
Well, you know, I want to launch on that, but we have another caller. Shall we take
our... Oh, good, good. Yes, let's do it.
Hello, you're on Blog Talk, Cosmic Citizen.
Hi there. This is Sheila from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Hey,
Paula,
Sheila.
Amanda. How are you doing?
Good. Great to hear from you.
Well, I was trying to listen to your program this morning and get home in time to do that, but I visited the local farmer's market here in Appleton, and I'm having too much fun. So I thought I'd give you a call on the radio and just say hi and tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Well, thank you, Sheila. This is Andre. I spoke with you actually by phone some time ago, and you and I have something in common, which is we've had some background in talk radio. I've been a co-host and producer for other shows as well. We've done the whole right-wing political talk radio circuit thing, and so it was kind of fun to compare notes with you about that. You're kind of a relatively new reader, right? You've been reading the book for about a year or so, or 2 years, or
correct.
That's awesome.
I bought the book.
I love to see new readers. I think it's just wonderful to find new people to see how excited they get about the revelation. So it's just great to have you on board.
Would you like me to share my story about that? Or
why not?
Questions that pop into your mind for new readers? I know you guys.
Sure. Go ahead.
Also, well, I was in our local Barnes and Noble bookstore looking for Mandela's one day, and store clerk sent me over to the New Age section, and I found my Mandela patterns, and it just so happened that the Urantia book with a picture of Jesus on the front cover was kind of just staring at me from the shelf there, and I thought, what is Jesus doing in the New Age section, you know, horror of horrors, he didn't belong there, and so I just picked up the book and read the back, and I thought, boy, this sounds pretty fascinating. I had plastic wrap around it, or shrink wrap, and I kind of peeked in there a little bit, and saw, boy, there's a lot of big words in here, and this sounds really interesting, and I think the copy at the time, I mean, it was only a year ago, it was like $20 or so, and I thought, well, you can't go wrong on that. So I bought it and took it home, and I started reading the foreword, and it was just like, boy, this really makes a lot of sense to me, and apparently that surprises a lot of long-time Urantia book readers, but it just seemed to make a lot of sense, so I just kept reading it, and I was so fascinated by it that I finished it in like 3 months' time. And
I think it's interesting it's interesting, though, Sheila, that you started with the foreword. I mean, I realize that's what the beginning of the book is, but that's one of the most difficult sections for people, so it's interesting that resonated with you right away.
Well, that's what people say, but I don't know. It just sounded like it was more information, like something I hadn't ever read before. And it just made so much sense. I just had to go on. And
you know, I agree with you, Sheila. I think that my first impression ever of the Urantia book as a 20-year-old, which was, I'm 53 now, and that impression has never left me. It was the only word I can think to describe it was a resonance. It had a resonance like nothing I have ever seen before or since. It resonated and reverberated through me. And even though I didn't, and we talked about this with Chris Halverson, even though I didn't really understand most of that forward, I knew that on a very deep level, that made perfect sense.
Yeah.
And it's going in. And so I just read it, and I told myself, I made myself a promise as a young reader, because unlike you, it took me 3 years to read it the first time. And many times I would read a paper, my brain would be so saturated with information. I mean, I would get to a point where it just felt like it was spilling out now. It couldn't hold any more, so I would stop, and I'd really let that sink in. And then I'd read another paper. And, of course, I was a young mother, and that's another reason why it took me. I could read maybe two or three papers a week, and it took me. But I made myself a promise as a young reader. I said, you know, I'm going to read a paragraph two or three times. If I still don't get it, I'm going to move on. And what I found was, as I did that, a couple of things. The more I read, the more I understood. The better I understood. The more I read, the more I resonated with the thought processes that went into those communications. And I started to resonate on a higher level of intellect so that it became more and more understandable. And I found that true as I've gone on these many years. The more I read it, the more I understand it, the deeper it gets, the better it gets. It's just truly, truly amazing that way. But the other thing I found was, as I read a paper or a page even, there would be a concept presented in three basic ways. The first way would be a scientific way, a very logical way of presenting it, almost like a science teacher might present that concept. The second way of presenting it would be a philosophical way, very deep philosophical and conceptual. The third way would be a spiritual way of presenting it. So each concept is, and this is my conclusion, each concept is presented in three basic ways, scientifically, philosophically, and spiritually. And if you're not a real deep scientific thinker, you're going to get it on a philosophical, spiritual level. And if you're not real philosophical, but you're scientific, you're going to get it on a scientific level. You know, so it's just all, no matter what, where you're coming from, it's going to reach you where you are. And the important thing is to just not worry about those paragraphs that you don't get, because for every one that went over my head, another one would like do a direct hit right to my heart. And I didn't want to miss any of those. So I just went through.
Well, that's pretty much how I approached it. There were many sections I didn't understand, still don't understand, but it still did reach me on a deeper level. And what I find fascinating is that, you know, there's not too many people to talk to the Urantia book about, although I do have a couple people here, and we do meet once a week. But, you know, you can't carry on conversations about this book with other people because they just don't know where you're coming from. And so you kind of get away from it a little bit, but then when you go back into it and you read it again, it's just like getting fed all over again, and it's just rich. You know, it's just so wonderful to go back into it every chance I get, you know.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I love my job so much is because as a young woman, I had read that thing for about 2 years. I was about two-thirds of the way through it, and I was literally crying out to talk to somebody about it. I mean, I had to talk to somebody, and I got that response that you were talking about. You mentioned that, you know, it seems like you try to tell people you love about the thing and they think you're crazy. You're talking
right.
About a book that has no author, and it claims to be authored by celestial beings, and they think you're nuts.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a letter to Urantia Foundation, and I said, I know I'm not the only person in the world that believes this. I can't be. I know there must be others. And please, I have to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And 22 years old, and they wrote me back. I'll never forget. I got a letter back from Emma Christensen. She said, you know, there are readers in your area. She said, you might have heard of Mo Siegel. He is the founder of Celestial Seasonings Tea Company. He's a reader, and he studies in your area. And then she gave me the name of another couple. And I went to both groups, and I started studying regularly with Mo Siegel and the study group in Boulder, Colorado, in 1977. And I've never looked back. I mean, that's another whole aspect. Group study is another whole aspect of the Urantia book that is just enthralling to hear other people's insights and the benefit of their experience with the book. It's, you know, what makes this talk radio show special, and hearing from someone like you. To hear from you as a new reader, for me, it's like being a new reader myself. It's like going through that maiden voyage, that voyage of discovery for the first time again. And to hear how it excites you and enthralls you revivifies me. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. Now, if I could ask you a two-part question, you and Andre, maybe you could help me with this. One is what is the best way to reach other people with the book, and why is it that some people seem to get it and other people don't? I mean, like, why doesn't it resonate with everybody?
Well, it's so funny you should say that. It's so funny you should say that, Sheila, because when you asked your first question, what's the best way to reach people with the book, my immediate response was, well, it depends on the person, because not everybody's going to be reached the same way. Secondly, why is it that some people get it and others don't? I think it's because this book isn't for everybody. You know, I think about, you know, going back to Jesus again. We just love Jesus. We're just a bunch of Urantia book Jesus freaks here. But anyway, we'll have to start a commune and you know, the whole thing. But if you look in the book, there is a section. I don't remember the paper. Is a section where Jesus is. It's called the Talk with Nathaniel. And Jesus is speaking to the Apostle Nathaniel, and the Apostle Nathaniel says, you know, Jesus, Master, I get the sense that you don't believe everything in the Bible is true, like the way the rabbis do. You know, you don't. The rabbis say that the words of the Bible, you know, are the words of the law, are the very words of God. They've been in heaven since the time of Abraham. And you know, and Jesus says, Nathaniel, you have rightly judged. But I'm not going to. But I'll only tell you this on condition that you will not repeat this to your brethren who are not prepared to receive this teaching. So basically, what happened was, Jesus told Nathanael that you know, the Bible was not completely the Word of God. There were things in it that were true and things that were not true. But he didn't tell everybody that, because not everybody would have accepted that. A lot of people would have just, you know, if Jesus had said that those things publicly, people who weren't ready to hear that, you know, he would have alienated a lot of people. He might have been crucified a lot more quickly than he had. you know, but more importantly, he would have alienated even the masses, the common people. We're just not ready to hear that. So I think we need to, I think the first thing I don't mean to sound patronizing when I say this, but we need to evaluate, I think, where someone is spiritually. Where are they intellectually? You know, are they, one of the things, I'll tell you something funny. You know how I introduced a lot of people to the Urantia book? Right now I have a potential girlfriend. We haven't met yet, but that we're going to meet in a few weeks. But before I started talking to her, I was posting profiles online and on some telephone dating services, okay? And I would say in my profile, I would say things like, I'm a Christian, but I'm a spiritual Christian, not a religious Christian. I don't care where you go. I don't care where you go to church. I don't care if you go to church. I only care that you have a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And I would talk about how I believed God was a loving God and not a jealous God. And I would hopefully, and you know, I was trying to attract a certain kind of person so that, you know, so I could share the Urantia book with them. And I was able, what I would often do when I spoke to a woman for the first time that I was possibly interested in, I would say to her, I'd say, have you ever considered the possibility that maybe your experience with God and Jesus was real, but that maybe not everything in the Bible was true? You know, and a lot of times, you'd be surprised. A lot of people I talked to when I asked them that question, a lot of them said, yes, I've thought about that. There are a lot of people sitting in church who are not fully satisfied with the answers they're getting, and privately they have questions. And so I think we need to ask, you know, we need to look at where someone is spiritually. If someone is not ready to go there, if someone is absolutely convinced, yes, everything in the Bible is true, then, you know, we can't share the Urantia book with them right away. What we can do is, I go to a Bible study. I study the Bible with some pretty conservative Christians, and I don't share the Urantia book with them at all. If I told them I was into this, they would, you know, they would be, they probably wouldn't have, unfortunately, a lot of them, they either wouldn't want anything to do with me or they would see me as a non-Christian. That already happened with one friend of mine when he found out I didn't believe in the atonement doctrine. He just told me I was never his brother in Christ, and it really was a very hurtful thing. But basically, what I try to do when I'm in Bible studies like that is just plant little seeds. You know, I'll say certain things like, I'll give you an example. I'm trying to go into business as a life coach, and I'm not trying to plug my business here, but I have a website that is going to be launched pretty soon called controversialcoach.com. I just wrote a blog on that website, and at the end of the, and I was actually criticizing a Christian event that I went to. It was actually kind of a negative blog, but in the blog at the end, I talked about, you know what, I'm tired of hearing these Christians talk about surrender all the time, that we should surrender our wills to God. And I basically quoted the Urantia book without quoting it directly, I mean, without citing it. I said, you know, when we give our wills to God, it's not a surrender of will. It's an affirmation of will. It's a glorification of will. And so, you know, I was able, and thankfully the Urantia book is in the public domain now, so I can do that I don't have to cite it or footnote it or anything like that. I can just, you know, share those teachings and share a concept that I think is appropriate, you know, at the time. And I know I'm rambling on here, but let me just say one last thing, and that is that I like the model that Paul uses in the Book of Acts in the Bible. He is speaking to the Athenians on Mars Hill, and these are pagan philosophers, a lot of them. And he says, you know, I can see by your idols that you're very religious. And I see you have an idol there to an unknown God. I'm going to show you who this unknown God is. It's Jesus Christ. So he doesn't attack these people. He doesn't say, oh, you're a bunch of superstitious idolaters, you know, who worship statues. He builds on what they already understand. And we see Jesus doing the same thing. He says, and I've quoted this line several times already on the air before, but I have to just say it again. You know, Jesus said, I didn't come to denounce the law and the prophets. You know, I've come not to take away that which you had from your forefathers, but to give you the perfected vision of that which they saw only in part. So, again, I think if we can build on where someone is, I think that's probably the most important thing. You know, if we can learn to read people, you know, where is someone spiritually? Where are they intellectually? Where are they philosophically? What kind of religious tradition have they been raised in? And then we can figure out what it is, you know, how much we can share, what's appropriate to share, what's not appropriate. Does that make sense to you, Sheila?
Yeah, it makes great sense. That was a very good answer.
Can I take a crack at that one, too?
Yes.
Because I had a really what I would consider a really deep insight about that just recently. I've pondered that question a lot because I've spent a lot of time trying to whet people's appetites for truth. Jesus said, you know, that we should get better at that, better at whetting their appetites for truth. And this insight was so invaluable to me. I was reading from the Life and Teachings of Jesus, the Ordination of the Twelve. Section 5, Fatherly and Brotherly Love. And this is where the midwayers, this is priceless to me. I love the midwayers because, you know, little background for those who don't know who the midwayers are. They've been down here with us for 37,000 years or more. They know us better than anybody. They are the permanent citizens of this world. They don't get to ascend until we reach light and life, and then they finally get to ascend. They know humans better than we would ever know ourselves, and they could probably predict at any time what we're going to do and the mistakes we're going to make. And they're just awesome brothers and sisters and servers of us, and I adore their commentary in the Jesus Papers. But they're making a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, and the Master says, "Happy are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." And then the midwayers say this. They say, only those who feel poor in spirit will ever hunger for righteousness. Only the humble seek for divine strength and crave spiritual power. But it is most dangerous to knowingly engage in spiritual fasting in order to improve one's appetite for spiritual endowments. Physical fasting becomes dangerous after 4 or 5 days. One is apt to lose all desire for food. Prolonged fasting, either physical or spiritual, tends to destroy hunger. Now, here's the insight I see. Later on in the book, they tell us, the midwayers tell us again, that one of the great dangers to civilization on this planet is secular materialism. And we know that the developed countries have it bad. Europe and the United States and the developed countries of the world are definitely into secular materialism, and that means godless materialism. Material things have become God. Now, the problem with that, and this is what occurred to me, people have lost their appetites for things spiritual because our culture is so decidedly secular. And we may not even know that it is, but it is. It's, you know, even religions of authority don't necessarily create a spiritual hunger in people. In fact, they may go a lot farther to quell their spiritual hunger than they do to stimulate it, because they don't like questions. They don't like people who question, and questions are what stimulates, the need for answers. So I think this is the insight. The reason it's so difficult for us to spread these teachings in the developed world is because there's no spiritual hunger, and you really need a spiritual hunger. You need a strong spiritual hunger to want to read the Urantia book. The Urantia book is going to feed you, but it's going to make you work. It's not an easy read, but if you really are hungry for answers, it's going to give you the answers. However, if there's no hunger there, I mean, and the other part of the insight I had was, how hard is it to get an anorexic to eat? You can give an anorexic the most sumptuous feast on earth, and they have no interest in it because they have lost their appetite. It's gone.
Wow, Paula, and I want to let Sheila interject as well. But before I do, I want to say a couple things. I'm going to take this opportunity to say some personal things on the air, which I don't normally say. But you know, I have a very difficult relationship with my mother. For those who know me, they know how difficult my relationship with my mom is, and unfortunately, I live with her at the moment. But my poor mom, I love her dearly, but she is exactly an example of what you're talking about, Paula. She is just completely caught up in secular materialism, has no interest really or hunger for spiritual things. And she just doesn't think that she needs God. And it's a very, you know, she's materially comfortable, and it's just a sad thing. And one of the things that's very interesting, my family came here, my mom came here from Ukraine, she came here from a communist country. And I noticed a big difference between her and her parents. Her parents were first-generation immigrants. They just arrived here, and they were both wonderful people. And my grandmother, in particular, my mom's side, was just a very spiritual person, very very into her Catholic faith, but in a very very alive and heartfelt way. It's interesting because I love immigrants, I really do, and I'm actually a very pro-immigration kind of guy. Okay, and I actually would like to see us let more people in. But the thing that's interesting is, one thing I've noticed, though, about a lot of immigrants is a lot of them, especially if they come from oppressed countries with a lot of oppression and poverty, is it's almost like they come to America and it's like they've died and gone to heaven. And so what ends up happening is it's very easy for them to idolize the American dream and to think, it's almost like they don't want to ask, is there more than this? Because they came from such bondage and such oppression that it's like they're so grateful to be here, but it's like they get to a place where they don't think they need anything more than this, because what they have here is so much better than what they had before that it's very easy for them to. I'm sorry.
It's almost like heaven to them. You know.
I'm sorry. I'm having a really hard time hearing you.
She said it's almost like heaven to them.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, that's why people call America heaven's door. That's one of the things people, and I understand that. Don't get me wrong. I think it's wonderful. I just think that we here who are born here have to be careful of this too. But I think immigrants too have to be careful that they don't turn the American dream into an object of idolatry. I find this to be more true, though, not so much of first generation immigrants, but more of second generation or first generation immigrants who came here. My mother helped her parents, get to a standard of living that they never would have dreamed of, and she got kind of caught up in the system. But I'll say something interesting though, Paula, and that is that you said that spiritual hunger is often lacking in the developed world. I think it depends on what part. I think we're in a better position than Europe. Europe has become extremely secularized. Very few people. It's very common in Europe for people to say they don't believe in God. I think we're still okay. I think we're still in a better position here in America. I think that and it's interesting because one thing that we have going for us now. It's interesting because a lot of people seem to work like crazy in America. They work long hours. But the flip side of that, though, is we have more leisure time than our ancestors did. Our ancestors, had to worry about where the next meal was coming from, and their whole life was, was about survival. And because we have more leisure time, we have an opportunity here to really reflect deeply on spiritual things and spiritual matters. So I hope that more of us do take that opportunity.
Okay, hang on for just...
That's a noontime siren here.
Okay. The message is that audio portion of our show is not being heard by people on the board.
The what? The audio portion of our show is not being heard?
Yeah. Hello, I'm gonna hang up for now. It was so great. Call back, okay?
Okay.
Hello?
Okay, I'm here, Andre.
Are we not on the air?
Oh no, I'm just getting messages on the board that the audio portion of the show blipped out for some folks, and several of them confirmed it. Now let's see. Someone said try refreshing. Our great technician Larry Watkins, who mans the boards, and he is our producer. Essentially, he sends out our announcements. He's just the best, Larry. I love you dearly.
Absolutely.
He said he told everybody to refresh, and supposedly that's working. So.
Okay. Good. We don't have to call back and reconnect or anything like that.
He's saying, okay, it's okay now if you'll refresh. So, folks, if you're having an audio problem, try refreshing. I don't know what the deal.
Hey, why don't we take this opportunity to take a musical break here? Why don't we? Can you give us some Fransel Garland maybe?
Yeah, you bet. Now, hopefully, Andre, this is Fransel because I need to go and name these bumpers so that I know who they are. But we'll try this one and see.
Wow. If any of you have any prayer requests, maybe you'd like us to pray for something. Maybe you know someone who's sick or going through a hard time, or maybe you yourself are going through a hard time, or maybe you have some praise that you want to share with us. Maybe God has done something really wonderful in your life and you'd like to share that with us. Please let us know. You can also email us if you want to at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. I don't check that mailbox as often as I should, but I am going to try to do that. That was Fransel Garland, by the way, and you can also look up her stuff at fransel.com. That's FRANCYL.com. Paula, one of the things I also want people to know, speaking of music, is we're going to try to also get some music from Pato Banton as well. And if there are any musicians listening, you have any original music that you would like to have us play on the show, please send it along. We can get, you know, if you have it in electronic files or MP3s or anything like that, that, you know, we can use those. So we're always looking to spice up our show here with some more music.
Okay, and also I just want to say to everybody, you know, thanks for hanging in here with us. We're getting your comments. You're just giving us some really great positive feedback, and it means so much to us. And thanks for hanging in with the technical difficulties inherent in the internet and inherent in the phone lines. you know, there's not a lot we can do sometimes when you get cut out. And I know that some of you have had problems, but we always work them out. Larry's always willing to help. And I really appreciate, and I know Andre appreciates your participation. We have, Quester said he tried to call earlier and didn't get through. I'm really sorry about that. But keep trying, folks. Don't give up because I'm manning these switchboards, and I see a caller right now. I'm going to put him through and see what happens. You ready, Andre?
I am ready.
Hello? You're on Blog Talk. Hello? Oh, no caller there. Well, Quester, you said you'd like to give us a call. Come on and call us up. And we were going to launch about Melchizedek. And, Andre, you had made your statement about Melchizedek. I just wanted to point out, and everything you said was absolutely right, the Urantia book says more about Melchizedek probably than, and about the order of Melchizedek. Which that in itself is a concept. The orders of beings is a concept that people don't hear very often. We are an order. We are the human
order. That's right.
That's
right.
Angels are an order. Melchizedek's are an order, and that means that they came. They're the firstborn of a local universe. They have a very specific job, a specific mission. One of the things they do is they go through the universe of universes teaching self-control and self-governance. Okay, so we have a call. Hold on. Let's take this one. Hi, 613. You're on Blog Talk. Cosmic Citizens. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me, Paula?
Yeah.
It's Dave Quester.
Hi, Dave.
And how are you doing?
Good, I'm glad you called.
Now,
what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to call in and try to be your first caller, but it was a little odd in that I guess when you get connected, you're actually hearing something that has not yet been streamed. So it's a little bit confusing sort of turn the volume off on the Blog Talk Radio end and just pay attention to what's happening on the phone.
I think most, Andre, wouldn't you say most phone shows are like that?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't you say most phone shows are like that? There's a delay?
Yeah, well, there's usually a delay between what goes on the air and what you hear. And what you hear on the phone, although that usually doesn't happen on hold. So I don't know why that happens here. I actually wasn't aware of that because I don't listen to the show from my computer, so I didn't realize that that's how it worked. But anyway, what is it you'd like to share with us, Dave?
Well, I just wanted to take advantage of the open mic to join in on the Blog Talk Radio show and just first of all say thanks very much for making this. Part of my Saturday routine. I think you're doing an excellent job, and your guests have been just fabulous. So well done,
well, thank you
guys.
Thank you. Is this Dave from Ottawa?
It's Dave from Ottawa. Yes.
Dave.
Oh wow! So you must have gotten a you must have a calling plan that includes the U.S. I keep forgetting that people in Canada, a lot of people in Canada, have that plan. So.
Yes, so fortunately I was able to connect. I was hoping to connect much earlier in the show when you were talking about Joshua's life on Earth here as an incarnated Michael Sun among us. And I wanted to suggest that perhaps we might want to look at one of the other missions he had in front of him during this incarnation. He was not only living among us to bring the message of the kingdom to mankind, the brotherhood of man, fatherhood of God, or the other way around, but he was also here to put an end to the Lucifer rebellion. And I don't know if that's a subject that's worth consideration on the show or not. But
just about any subject is worth consideration. So I think that that's Do you have any thoughts about that that you'd like
to share? Well, the one thought I wanted to share on that notion has to do with parables. And this this was I was made aware of this by Musa Ndiaye. I don't know if his name is familiar to your audience, but he's a professor from Senegal who quite often visits North America and gives seminars that are very much based on Urantia Book teachings. But he pointed out to me a couple of years ago that these parables are really marvelous tools in that they have so many levels of meaning. And in particular, we were talking about the lost sheep, and it was suggested that that we might consider the lost sheep as being Lucifer himself. And part of the bestowal mission, Jesus was busy trying to bring that particular lost sheep back to the fold.
Wow.
I just thought, you know, that that was such an interesting dimension to parables that I had never given any thought to or even been aware of before, and I just wanted to share it and see where it might take us.
Are you saying that Jesus was trying to save Lucifer and Caligasta, perhaps, by...
That was the suggestion made to me, and it seems so very reasonable. I mean, if we look back to what we were told in the Urantia book about this seventh bestowal, it was a multidimensional mission. And as I mentioned, one of Christ Michael's missions was to bring an end to the Lucifer rebellion. And so very often when you hear him going away for a season, as the Urantia book puts it, to speak with his father, it's also possible he was away to speak with Lucifer and offer this abundant mercy that we're so well familiar with.
We do know, Dave, that Jesus, because that Jesus was not in the business of judging. The judgment is delegated to the Ancients of Days. So we know that Jesus only offered Lucifer mercy. That's something that I think the book even says that specifically.
The parable of the lost sheep at this other dimension, it's not a question of judging Lucifer so much as it is an attempt to bring him back to the flock, so to speak.
Well, that's very interesting. What I want to kind of comment on, and I mentioned this, I think, on the show when we had Ann on the show a few weeks ago, Ann Garner. This is kind of an opposite take on what you're saying, but you talk about the parables having a level of meaning. Have so many levels of meaning. I think it's interesting that so many conservative Christians look at the word lost, and they look at that word and they think that means people who are damned or people who don't have salvation. See, I don't think that it's apparent from the parable that that's what Jesus is talking about. I think you know what Jesus is saying is, you know, we're all children of God, and just like all children, sometimes children wander away from their parents, and they need to be brought back home. So I don't think lost always means damned or unsaved or someone who is iniquitous or apart from the Father. I think a lot of times loss can just mean, someone who's just wandered away and just needs to be gently brought back home. And I think that doesn't contradict what you're saying either, because, as I said, as you so rightly pointed out, parables do have many levels of meaning.
Well, and you know, I want to share something from the book on this very topic, Dave and Andre, because, and it's from the Sojourn on Mount Hermon. The Transition Years, Paper 134, Section 8. This is where Lucifer, obviously, and Caligastia tempt Jesus while he's there in the wilderness. And it's right after his baptism. It's, you know, the same story that all biblical Christians have always held dear, the Master in the 40 days, and he's tempted. And this sentence intrigues me because I'm a parent and I understand it. Jesus, it says, many proposals and counterproposals of the emissaries of Lucifer, Jesus only made reply, "May the will of my paradise Father prevail, and you, my rebellious son, may the Ancients of Days judge you divinely. I am your Creator Father. I can hardly judge you justly, and my mercy you have already spurned. I commit you to the adjudication of the judges of a greater universe." You know, the part that intrigues me is when he says, I am your creator father. I can hardly judge you justly. And in that is the love and the mercy of a father who would never condemn his son. You just can't. It's not possible. It's not possible. And so, you know, I feel his heart in that saying. I feel his heart. I really relate to the pain of the rebellion from his point of view. To see his children betray each other and harm each other, and that it continues to go on this planet from the day that the rebellion broke out on this world until now, until this moment, and on every world in Nebadon where the rebellion broke out, what happens is it's a betrayal of trust, and it just keeps happening. And we keep perpetuating this this betrayal and harming each other in this way. And for me, really, the greatest purpose of him coming was to save the little children who were suffering. And it's just like, you know, and that's us. That's us. We were taken into this thing before we knew what was happening to us. And we never, unlike some other planets in this system who went into the rebellion knowing what they were doing, we didn't. We were taken in very young. We had no clue. And now, you know, hundreds of thousands of years later, we still deal with it, and our children still deal with it. And I was thinking just today, I'm so glad you brought this up, Dave, because this thought occurred to me today as I was driving home from the bank this morning. I thought, what would our world be like if Jesus had never come here? You know, we know he could have come to any world, but he chose us, and I was just thinking that. What would it be like if he hadn't come here? And the very next thought I got, I shuddered. But the very next thing that occurred to me then is, I wonder if we'd even still, if this world would still exist. I know the human race would exist because the book tells us that we are of paramount value. Once initiated on a world of space, a human race must continue, regardless of the continuance of that planet. So we know we'd still exist, but where would we be now if Jesus hadn't come here? Have you ever thought about that?
To tell you the truth, I haven't. I don't know whether I have this predilection not to speculate on imponderables or what, but no, I can't say I've ever thought of that.
Well, you know, that's funny.
I've been so grateful that he has.
It's funny, David, because there's a couple of books. One's called "What If Jesus Had Never Been Born," and the other one, I don't remember the name of it, but it's I don't remember the name of the other book, but I think there's so many things we take for granted in our civilization that are a product of Jesus' teachings. And I realize that there was, you know, the Hippocrates, the doctor, was around before Jesus, and there were doctors, and there was, but think about things. I mentioned, for example, Jesus' love for children. The pagan cultures really didn't value children the way we value children. They didn't believe children had intrinsic and inherent dignity. If they didn't want a child, as I said, they would throw the child out to the elements. There are so many things, orphanages, hospitals, charity. There's so many things that we take for granted in our civilization that, you know, are here because of Jesus' teachings. Just all the things that I think about things like the profession of psychotherapy, you know, which a lot of people may not think about this, but, you know, the profession of psychotherapy, not all schools of psychotherapy, but a lot of psychotherapy has been influenced by the teachings of Jesus. You know, we talk about, you know, we teach communication skills there. We talk about the value of listening. If you take counseling courses, I mean, what are those but not affirmations of, you know, ministry? That, you know, they're a kind of ministry, even if they're being done in a secular way. Although there are also plenty of faith-based counseling opportunities. But I mean, there's so many things I think of. I mean, I think if Jesus hadn't been here, I think we'd still, in a lot of ways, we'd probably be living like savages.
Can I share with you guys something that it always inspires me? And it's, of course, the Christian writing, and many, many Christian writings are absolutely fantastic to me. I think they're beautiful. And we see right now that powerful ministers like Joel Osteen and books like The Purpose-Driven Life are just really having an impact on Christian thought. And I'm so encouraged by that. But this is something, I don't even know who wrote it. It's called One Solitary Life. And since we're pondering this meaning of Jesus' birth on earth at this moment, I just want to share this. It says, and I know this isn't absolutely correct according to the Arantia book in terms of some of the facts, like, you know, his age and stuff, but it says he was born in an obscure village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. He then became an itinerant preacher. He never held an office. He never had a family or owned a house. He didn't go to college. He had no credentials but himself. 20 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. All the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned, have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life. Isn't that so beautiful?
Wow. It's also just so true. I mean, it's how ironic. It's the great irony. You know, why would someone like this be, you know, why would someone like this be the center of our civilization? Why? There must have been something so special about him that it's just amazing. And I think it gives comfort to all those who feel like maybe they're not, they don't have a lot of status in the world, they're not very successful. And I'm not saying that they're all going to be, you know, that they're all going to be as important as Jesus. But you know, in a sense, there's a sense in which we all will not be equal to Jesus, but we will all be... you know, the most humble soul here on earth, you know, can become a finaliter. I mean, isn't that incredible?
I think it really is, and this ties back, I think, to the conversation you guys were having with Sheila about how, for some, the Arantia book just resonates, and for others, it's just not worth taking off the shelf. And I think, you know, if you look at the name I'm known by on your chat board, Questor, I picked that name because I think of myself being very much on a quest, a spiritually driven quest. And what Jesus did for the world was make them sensitive to just exactly what it was this inner spark is leading us towards, and that's our Father, and this journey of ascension that eventually spiritualizes us to the point that we can approach our Father on paradise and say, "Hi, guy. You know, I'm your son, and I've made it back home."
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that so true? Well, you know, I think it's you know, it all has value. Dave on the board said, you know, he doesn't go to what ifs, and I understand that. I appreciate that. Sometimes my mind just goes there, though. I've thought about what if Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted, and I find value in that only insofar as it gives me an insight to the meaning of what actually did happen. You can't change history, but when you contemplate the world and how it is, you know, in one of my dear friends is Mo Siegel, obviously, and Mo is such an optimist. I really count on him to keep me in perspective, because sometimes I get caught up in the negatives of the world, you know. I think that's a motherly thing, you know. We worry about our children so much, and we see the dangers of the world, and it's terrifying to think that you're sending children and grandchildren out there to deal with this stuff, and what are they, you know, what are we leaving them, that kind of thing. And Mo always points out history, and he always tells me, "Paula, look how far we've come." And I love that, because then I really start to reflect on even my own life. I can remember a time in my life when children could get beat on the street by their parents and nobody would say a thing. I can remember that happening as a child. I can remember seeing children get whipped right out in public, and nobody said a thing. We have come so far.
They really have, and I'm so glad you're saying this, Paula, because it's amazing. I hear people talk about the good old days. What was good about the good old days, you know? I mean, I'm not saying everything's rosy today. We've taken some steps forward and some steps backwards, but you're kind of making a point, though, too, which is that, you know, humane treatment, you know, where does that come from? You know, it really comes from, you know, from the teachings of Jesus. You know, there are things that are so much more humane today, and there are other ways in which I think we really have regressed, yes. But, you know, if you think about the things that we can thank Jesus for, you know, the abolition of slavery in America. We can thank Jesus for, you know, as I said, for, you know, improved medical conditions. There's so many things that, you know, that we owe to the Spirit of Jesus. And I think quite literally to the Spirit of Jesus, because I wonder if the Spirit of Truth being here, has really made, it has had to have made a difference.
Oh, there's just no doubt about it in my mind. And, you know, I want to also mention that Ann Garner has something. She says something that we did a lot of the introductions to the Arantia book together. We traveled a lot, and we talked, did public introductions to the book. And I just want to share this because it's so touching. We're talking about the value of this one human life on this planet. And Anne started out an introduction, and she would always take the part four. She would always introduce part four, much to my chagrin. I wanted to do it, but I would her do it. And she started out by saying, Jesus. That word is powerful, isn't it? Jesus. Even the word has power. And then she said, and it was humorous, I'll never forget, she said, people say that word because it has power. She said, how many times have you been watching a Hollywood movie and a guy drives off a cliff in his car and says, oh, Confucius! And I always think, that's right. Nobody says, oh, Confucius. Nobody says, oh, Buddha. They say Jesus because that word has power. And whether we admit it or not, it's like that thing I just read about one solitary law. He changed it more than anything on this world. We date our calendar to him. What's that about?
Well, it's so funny because, you know, it's so funny you should say it because I don't know if this is what Anne was referring to, but, you know, he will talk about taking the Lord's name in vain. I don't think that's what the Bible means when people say, oh, Jesus Christ, or oh, my God. I don't think that's really what they're talking about. I think they're talking about swearing oaths and lying about, you know, swearing an oath and not meaning it. But the point I'm making, though, I think the point that she's making maybe is still a good one, though. You're right. I mean, when people are just, being frivolous and saying, oh, Jesus, or oh, my God, they don't say, you're right, they don't say, oh, Buddha, or oh, Confucius, you know, they don't do that. And I it's really interesting because sometimes I think when people say things like that, like, oh, dear God, or oh, Jesus, I wonder if sometimes people may be praying unconsciously. And maybe I'm grasping at straws to some extent, but I think so, there are times when we say those things, and we actually may mean those things more significantly than we may realize at first.
Well, can I share a story with you along those lines?
Sure.
I had a video store for many years, and we were talking about ministering as we passed by. I found wonderful opportunities to minister to my customers as they came in, and just on off days. And I had a dear friend. His name was Doug Paul, and he was raised Jewish. And he told me that one day he was driving. It was a lot of, you know, bad day, snowstorm, big snowstorm in Denver. And he said he was trying to get from point A to point B, and he went sliding into the back of a bus. And he said, It was so funny, Paula. As I was sliding into the back of this bus, I said to myself, he said, I went into slow-mo, and I said to myself, oh, Jesus, help me. And then he said, I thought, wait a minute, I don't even believe in you. And then I thought, oh, it doesn't matter. Jesus, help me anyway. And I always remember that because, you know, it's just what you just said, Andre. I think unconsciously, whether we admit we believe in him or not, and I think that's the point Anne was getting at.
Yeah. Jay, do you have anything else you'd like to share with us here?
Not at the moment, really. No, and as I try to cue you in on the chat board, I think it's perhaps time I hang up the phone and let somebody else have a chance to to join
well,
in
to have
the
you
open
on the
mic
show.
Show.
Please feel free to call in any time.
Yeah,
oh,
thanks,
you can count on it. Cheers,
thanks,
all.
Too. Okay, we have another caller. Let's see if this is we'll see if this one works. The switchboard sometimes has a delayed reaction, so we'll see. It's not. It doesn't look like a real caller, but we'll see. Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
I am actually a real caller, Paula.
Yes. If you know how your number turns up, 111-111-1111.
Well, you know I was born 11-11-47.
So that has got to be a reason
how
for
your
it.
Name and your number is showing up on the switchboard. All ones, Anne. It's
oh,
all.
My word. Oh, my Jesus. Hello, Andre.
Hello, Anne.
How much I enjoy y'all each Saturday. I set my timer on my cell phone. I set an alarm clock, and then I make sure my dog and cats let me know when y'all are coming on the air. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Such a blessing. I want to briefly ask a question and then share briefly an experience I had last night and this morning. My question, I'm about to write about faith and healing from the reflections of the Urantia book, and it can only be 200 words, is for an interfaith group, so I need your feedback. But before we go there, I had an interaction last night with some of my Chinese friends who are Confucius people and really do not believe in a personal God. And we've been talking about that at length over the last few months. And we were at a gathering, and I sat down at a table, and there was a fundamentalist Christian there who's a missionary. And I was amazed at how demeaning he was to my precious friends who really do believe in God. They just have never had an opportunity. They just got here from China.
Right, right.
And at one point, one of my Chinese friends was trying to ask a question about, is it possible for Jesus, and he would say, Jesus reborn. So the man never would take time, and this is a huge lesson for us as Urantia book readers, not to be fundamentalists ourselves, of that fine line of declaring the gospel versus trying to get people to read the book. And he didn't take time to understand if he meant the rebirth experience or could Jesus be reborn. So I simply asked, what are you asking? I'm, you know, trying to understand. So what he meant was, could Jesus possibly be born again on the planet? The way the gentleman answered the question, a very powerful missionary, said, Jesus died on the cross for your sins. You're going to hell if you don't believe that.
Oh, boy.
And then he said, he resurrected and came and appeared again here to judge everybody.
Ooh.
So I'm sitting there, and I told my husband this morning, I said, I actually became nauseated.
Oh, I want to cry when I hear something
and
like
that. And I looked at him in the moonlight, and I said, sir, did Jesus say he came to judge? And he jumped up very angrily. I actually thought the man was going to hit me. One simple question. He slammed the chair back down on the ground, and he said, stop trying to do my job. And he stormed off.
Wow.
And I apologized profusely to the gentleman there. I said, I apologize. And they said, no, we find that quite interesting. You simply were asking one simple question. I did go over and apologize to the man. I said, I apologize. I thought it was an open conversation. He said, you were trying to do my job. I said, and what is that? I thought we were just all eating here together. He said, we have to get these people saved before they go back to China. I said, sir, I went back to him again. He refused to come back to the table. I said, sir, I'm not going to sit over there. You go ahead and you sit and continue whatever you're wanting to do. And I didn't. I didn't go back. And I thought that was, these gentlemen are very intelligent and they're spiritual in their own way. And they came to me, every one of them, before they left. It was 10 or 11 of them. I think it was 11. And they privately said, we want to sit with you. We like the Jesus that you reflect.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's funny, Anne, because even the Bible says Jesus didn't come. Well, it does talk in places about judgment, but it also says, you know, Jesus did not come here to condemn the world, but to save the world. So,
well,
you know,
I actually asked him in reflecting the Bible, not, you know, because this was quote-unquote a biblical scholar. But, you know, when you got this missionary spirit about you, you have to be very cautious because I have a feeling, notice this is just my opinion, that they almost have to have a quota, you know? And
I know what you're saying. Yeah, it's almost like people become, you know what, unfortunately, and I love my Christian brothers and sisters. I'm a Christian myself. But one thing that concerns me is it's almost like people become cannon fodder for the gospel. It's like,
ooh.
Well, how many souls got saved tonight? You know, how many? It's like,
yes.
And it's almost and what I heard one Christian actually criticize this mentality, and he said, you know what, they don't have value because they're saved. We need to make sure they get saved because they already have value. So it's almost like people only have value in these people's eyes to the extent that they become, you know, to added to their numbers, you know.
You're either in or you're out.
There it is, Paula. And I want to compliment another group of Christians. The doorbell rang this morning, and my husband went to the door, and I walked out, and it was Jehovah Witnesses. And we ended up sitting down on the stoop of the stairs. It was a young 11-year-old girl. I don't know what it is about all the ones and 11s this morning with the older lady.
Hmm.
We had a marvelous conversation, and I complimented the lady, and I gave the young girl a shell from the beach that I picked up after our conference there in L.A. on Dana's Beach, there in Venice Beach, you know, our daughter. And I said, you've learned a lot from this wise lady. She didn't come here to judge me. And we had a marvelous conversation, and I complimented her. I said, you know, 10 years ago, I don't think I would have heard this from a Jehovah Witness. You acknowledge that you believe I'll wake up, that because even though I'm not a Jehovah Witness. She said, absolutely.
Oh, that's great.
I said, we clarified about the 144,000. She said, well, we believe that's a number, but we're not sure exactly what number that will be, that will be rulers in the heavens. And I said, oh. And I actually heard out of my mouth, I said, so it's not a literal number. Could that be finaliters? And I heard myself say that. And she said, well, that's an interesting word. And I'd never thought of that before. And I said, well, I don't know if I'd want to be a ruler. And I said, perhaps a servant. And she said, well, I like that word better. And then I said, well, do you believe that paradise, do you believe heaven is here on earth, will be here on earth? She said, no, there's a difference between heaven and paradise. And she said, we believe heaven is out there, and that's where all the angels and God and all. And she said, but there will be a paradise on earth similar to when Adam and Eve was here. I said, well, do you believe there could be other planets that could also do the same thing? She said, I never thought about that, but that's very possible. And, now, you know, that was a fascinating conversation.
Mm.
And, of course, you know they refer to Jesus' name in the heavens as Michael. The Jehovah Witnesses did.
Yes, they do. That's the first place I ever heard that mentioned, that Jesus and Michael were the same being, was from the Jehovah's Witnesses.
So I'm not wearing a hat, but if I did, I would hats off. That, and I thanked her for what I, and I told her what I experienced last night. No names, but just, and I said, I want to thank you for restoring my, the sense of missionary respect. It takes a lot of courage in what you do, and I have seen a shift in your community over the last 10, 15 years. So I just want to give you all that praise report. And two different reports there. Contrast. Andre, you ask about prayers. Paula, you're on the list server. I would like for us to pray. You know, there was a prayer request this week. Do you recall that? Out of San Francisco.
Yes, of course I do.
And I have his name here. And you.
So we're going to say a prayer for Christopher.
Yes, this is our dear friend's son, and perhaps she is listening. And so that's the main reason I'm calling in, those items. And I would like you to discuss briefly faith and healing reflected from the Urantia book. Is it possible by faith to be healed on the planet today? I'm just going to say that's the way I was asked to do it. Reflect faith and healing from your perspective, your community's perspective. And this is for an interfaith group. It'll end up on a website.
Okay, I really want to say something about this. I was healed by faith from cancer. I know it's possible.
You sure were.
Just like the woman who was burdened with the scourge and the hemorrhage that wouldn't go away. And she pressed up against the master and touched the hem of her garment. And she drew out of him life energy by the power of her faith. And I love that story because to me there's a humorous element in it. It's like Jesus Christ Superstar, you know. He's walking down the street with his apostles all around him. The throngs of people are pressing up against him. They're pressing on him, pressing. This whole crowd of people is pressing to get close to the master. And he stops in the middle of all of this and says, "Somebody touched me." And Peter looks at him, I'm sure, with utter disbelief and says, "Well, yes, Master, of course somebody touched you. There's people all around." And he said, "No, somebody touched me. Somebody drew living energy out of me." And he turned, and here was this woman with the holding on to the hem of his garment and proclaiming that she's been healed. And she said, "You know, you've healed me." And he said, "Woman, it is your faith that has healed you." And there it is right there. He said it himself. She believed strongly enough that if she just could touch the hem of his garment, she'd be healed. And she was.
And I love that. And there were a lot of people pressing around him. And he perceived power. And another time he perceived life.
And it was drawn right out of him.
Well, I've had several times.
By somebody's faith.
Well, I have a question to both of you. What about the statement in the papers that says you can't have, you know, well, of course, this is the midwives. They're questioning because they question. They're very sincere, and we know they're not perfect. But they're questioning these peculiar healings in the presence of this powerful personality. But there's a statement about that same kind of power cannot be here since he's not here in the his personal presence. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I have to, what comes to mind then is another quote from him. It's from the Mount of Transfiguration. And when he came down, you know, and the apostles, while they were up there in the Mount of Transfiguration with his three apostles, I believe it was Peter, James, and John, and they had seen Melchizedek and the Father Melchizedek and Gabriel, and they were just blown away, and they were coming down the mountain. Meantime, the other apostles were in camp, and this father came with his epileptic son, and the apostles made bold to try to heal his son, and they miserably failed. Well, Jesus, coming down the mountain, knew that this had all been going on. He's like a parent that comes in a house and knows something's amiss. And And the father came up to the master and said, these men said they could heal my son, but they didn't, and no, it was a mess, you know. And so Jesus healed the son, right? I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Sure.
But later he addressed the apostles, and he was very stern. And he told them this, and this is so beautiful. It's from Life and Teachings of Jesus, obviously, paper 158, in Celsius Garden, section 6. He says to them, no sooner does your faith grasp the identity of the Son of Man than your selfish desire for worldly preferment creeps back upon you, and you fall into discussing among yourselves as to who should be greatest in the kingdom of heaven, a kingdom which, as you persist in conceiving it, does not exist nor ever shall. Have I not told you that he who would be greatest in the kingdom of my Father's spiritual brotherhood must become little in his own eyes, and thus become the server of his brethren? Spiritual greatness consists in an understanding love that is godlike and not in an enjoyment of exercise for material power for the exaltation of self. And this is the important part. He says, in what you attempted, in which you so completely failed, talking about the healing of the epileptic boy, your purpose was not pure. Your motive was not divine. Your ideal was not spiritual. Your ambition was not altruistic. Your procedure was not based on love, and your goal of attainment was not the will of the Father in heaven.
Goal of attainment. I like
and
that.
So I take that and say, okay, Master, are you saying that if our purpose is pure, our motive is divine, our ideal is spiritual, our ambition is altruistic, our procedure is based on love, and our goal of attainment is the will of the Father, then it is possible to heal?
Love that. Thank you, Paula. Thank you. That helped me tremendously.
I believe that's what he was saying.
Yeah. You know, since you asked me what my opinion is as well, I'll just say, I guess I don't really have an opinion on that particular passage, but I'll say, as far as healing goes, I don't think there's anything in the Erastra book that would say that it's not possible. I think it's one of those things that the book leaves kind of unanswered. The only thing, I certainly believe it's possible. The question is, I guess my only concern is a question of balance, because there are, because Jesus didn't heal everybody that wanted to be healed. Because that wasn't his primary mission. His mission wasn't just to go around healing people, although he did do it, because he has a heart of compassion and mercy. My only concern is people who, is this kind of mentality that some people have, well, you know, you didn't get healed because you didn't have enough faith, and so people get shamed and condemned, because it may not have been God's will for that person to be healed at that time. Let me just say that I think it's interesting the quote you just read, Paul, about your motive wasn't divine, what was it that wasn't pure?
Your purpose.
Oh, the purpose wasn't pure. Okay, this is very interesting because I struggle with this because I think obviously what Jesus said was absolutely true in that particular passage, but I think we need to be careful that we also don't go to the other extreme and think, because the fact is none of us have totally pure motives all the time. We can, and it's okay to come to Jesus with mixed motives at times. I mean, we all have thoughts that come into our heads that we don't necessarily, and we regret them later and that kind of thing. I think, I guess what I'm saying is we have to ask ourselves, is our motive, when we get down to the bottom of it and we go, is our motive still divine? Because we're all going to have struggles. I guess what I'm saying is Jesus isn't asking for perfection there. He's not saying, you didn't heal this boy because you weren't perfect. I don't think that was his point. I think his point is that they weren't doing it with a spirit of integrity. They were doing it with ulterior motives. It was like, let's see how much glory we can bring to ourselves by doing, and that was basically it. That was their primary focus. Now, if I am ministering to someone and maybe I have a thought like, I bet they'll really appreciate this. I don't think we need to beat ourselves up and say, oh my gosh, I just had a terrible motive. So we are, I guess it's just one of those things that, you know, Jesus was living in a time when the Pharisees were they were very spiritually arrogant. But I think there also are people, and I think we probably count ourselves among them. There are people who go to the opposite extreme, where they just they think so they have such a low self-esteem that they feel guilty. And I know I've done this before. I feel guilty if I ever have any kind of a thought that is good about myself or my own achievements or my own accomplishments. And I don't think Jesus is saying to us, you know, that we have to be perfect in every thought. I think his point though is that we need to have integrity, and I think that's really what he was talking about there.
I agree, Andre. That's the gist of it. It's not that you have to be perfect to heal and to be a healing force. I think any of us can be a healing force for others if we care that much. And it's just like we were saying at the beginning of the show, Jesus was able to change people's lives just by smiling at them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, and when you think about that, how easy is it to smile at somebody? And if you knew the kind of day they were having and that you could just smile at them and make their day better, and bring some light and love and peace into their day, why would you not do it? So, you know, it's just interesting. I love the question about healing, though, because, you know, we can heal. But, I have to come to the place also where the apostle took Jesus out to the well where all the sick people were and said, Master, can we heal them?
Mm.
And Jesus said, well, they'd like that, wouldn't they? But many of them are sick because of years of riotous living. But we can, he said, no, we won't heal them, but we will speak comforting words to them. So, you know, healing, it isn't always about just getting better physically. It's a central lesson of Jesus to seek first the kingdom, and
right,
all things needful will be added.
Well, I know y'all are closing your broadcast, but thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for calling in. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
And the deepest prayer for young Christopher.
We'll hold him in light and life, huh?
Yes. Thank y'all so much.
Thanks, Dan. Love you.
And I hope I did okay with the gentleman last night.
I'm sure you did.
I apologize. And he did hug me before we left.
Oh, good.
Yes. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have one more caller, Andre. Do you think we have enough time to take one more?
How much time do we have left?
We have 5 minutes.
Well, let's see what we can do here in the next 3 or 4 minutes here. Who's calling here?
Hi, caller.
Hi.
We have 5 minutes.
Okay. This is Bob Arkins. I'm in Wisconsin.
Hey,
Bob.
Hi. On faith and healing, I know a priest, an Episcopal priest, who's built a reputation on having healing masses and a ministry of healing because of the reputation. And I asked him, because of faith healings and all this stuff, what do you do when people aren't healed? And he said, they are always healed. I just don't presume to know how. He's got a couple of stories that he then told me, and I'll share one. He, because of the reputation he's built up, he got a call from a lady who he didn't know to come and pray over her mother, who was in the hospital with the late stages of cancer. He did that and anointed her with oil, said the prayers, and then left. Bumped into the lady several weeks later and said, oh, how's your mother doing? And, oh, well, she died several days later. And, well, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And the lady said, no, that's quite all right. All after you left, and she claimed it was a result of all this, a lot of family schisms were healed.
Wow.
Things between sisters and brothers and mother and dad were healed.
Amazing.
Yes. So the family died. I mean, not the family died. The mother died in peace, and the family was left with peace. We can't presume to know. We can't dictate how we want to be healed. But as Father Paul would say, there is always healing that happens.
Wow. I love that story, Bob.
That's awesome. And that's a great way to close our show, Bob. Thank you very much. It's
You're
great
welcome.
To hear
Bye-bye.
From you. And please call in any time. That's a wonderful story, and it's really edifying, and that's great.
Thank you. We'll see you again. Bye.
Are you there?
I just want to say to our callers, all of you who called in today, thank you so much. It was a delight to hear from you. And me and Andre have been looking forward to this show, and now I know why, because it was great to hear from you. It was great to see all of the discussion on the chat board. Thank you, Brother Dave, for your wonderful comments that you make on the chat board. Thanks again to Larry for manning our board, and wow, what a great show.
It really was. Thanks a lot, Paula, and we will see you guys next week when we will be speaking with Larry Mullins about a history of the Urantia Papers. Thanks again, and may you all receive healing this week. God bless you.
God bless. Bye for now.